Welcome to another episode of Foreign, Domestic, and Forbidden, el mejor podcast del planeta. Soy Tim Trash.
Yo soy Joaquín Lobito.
And we'll be your host for the next hour. Joaquín, how are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to see you. Happy that we have this amazing guest. I'll wait for you to introduce her. But I'm good. I'm good. I'm free for a couple of days. My son is away on a retreat.
Oh.
And that's exciting. I don't have to wake up at 5:50.
A high school retreat?
Yeah, high school retreat. He goes to a Catholic high school. So I hope he doesn't get kicked out of school because he's not a Catholic boy. And he...
Wow.
No, he's very smart. He'll manage to deal with the priest. And unlike his father, who was kicked out of catechism but because he dared contradict the bishop. And he was politely asked not to come back when I was like 13 or 14. Yeah.
Weird.
So this is good. I'll go and watch again Killers of a Flower Moon because I've been waiting for that film for ages. And then we went to watch it like a week ago and I fell asleep for like 20 minutes. So now I have to go back and watch the whole thing again because I miss very important stuff. And I love Scorsese. So, you know, that's my thing to do today after a conversation.
Oh, cool.
How about you?
Well, it's been raining up here, so I haven't heard anything official yet, but I think the fire season is over. It's been raining on and off for the past 2-3 weeks. It's
right.
Never been wetter, sort of on a general level. It wasn't like gigantic downpour, flooding, or any of that, but it's been raining constantly, sort of like here and there. So it's been really nice. I didn't have to water the plants anymore. And everything is still blooming, which is so everything is on its second wind bloom. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
It looks
beautiful.
It looks gorgeous. And yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, it's not yet Thanksgiving, but I think everybody at school is sort of heading to the exits and not really doing much anymore. Everybody is taking it slow. A lot of people will be gone for the whole week next week. So I think for a week, 10 days, we're safe from any major horribleness or weird announcements, or we'll see. But I'm very hopeful. It feels already very different.
What are you going to do? You and I grew up without Thanksgiving. I mean, it's totally foreign to us. I'm Mexican. We don't have Thanksgiving. Did you have something like that in Germany?
We did. We had actually something that was called Erntedankfest, which is sort of a rough equivalent, but it's more like in August, September. And it wasn't a huge deal. I mean, it wasn't like this national hanging out and getting stuffed and playing football kind of thing. It was just... if you were religious, you might go to church, but it wasn't like sort of this the usual church thing. It was more like sort of just celebrating. It wasn't a big deal at all. I mean, really. So no, but that's kind of cool about my Thanksgiving because there isn't this whole family thing. Uncles and aunts are not piling into their cars and into the house, or so it's. It's very quiet, very, very chill, you know.
Do you guys cook turkey?
No, we're going to KFC. Crispy chicken tenders.
Great.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We do arigato giving because we go to Japantown and have Japanese food.
Oh, nice.
So
nice.
Maybe we should try the KFC dinner.
I have really like respect for KFC. We did with friends once a fried chicken competition, and we bought fried chicken from a really super highfalutin expensive restaurant, and we bought KFC and had sort of an eat-off. And in the one from the highfalutin restaurant was better, no doubt about it. But KFC held up really, really well. It's actually pretty decent, you know. Like it's good, and so it's right around the corner from here. So yeah.
Well, it's good because it's bad for you. Everything that's bad for you is good.
I know. Which brings us. No, that's not a good segue. But that was the worst segue ever. Oh my god. No, but Thanksgiving brings us to Jane Dykema, who's here for a three-peat, but we haven't seen you in a year. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
I'm just going up to Maine and trying to hide. Yeah.
Are there big family gatherings at your place or somewhere else?
No, not big. I think it's just like my in-laws and I think that's it, which will be nice actually.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah.
You're not allowed to say otherwise anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, it'll be familiar.
Even if it weren't true. So today's topic is super heavy. I'm not exactly sure how to get us sort of started off, but maybe with the intro that Joaquin and I started talking about a week ago about the subject. We started reaching it and then thought, oh, we should actually talk about that. Very revealingly and weirdly on air. And that was that we realized that we had always had trouble looking like our dads and not liking our dads a whole lot. And so we were thinking about, this might be like sort of a bigger topic, larger topic. There are all kinds of weird, dark pockets and niches I think we can explore. But we also, because we know that we're two disgruntled, grouchy guys, also wanted another perspective on the whole thing. And what better perspective than Jane's on this one? And so anybody wants to start off on problems with parents who loom large? And I should also say, and then I'll shut up, that it's becoming more and more of a problem, like a long-term problem. In the olden days when people died when they were 60 or 70 or so, you had quite a few years by yourself enjoying sort of this, I'm the oldest in the family, which is an acquired taste, but whatever. But nowadays people live to a very, very old age. And so like people are 75 and they're still calling their parents, hey mom, hey dad. And so,
oh god, that's so weird. Yeah, that's not good. Well, let me shift it a little bit. So I don't want us to be, like you said, grouchy old men complaining about their dads that, you know, we're over 50 and that's not good. I was thinking that, you know, we as writers, as readers, at some point we realize that we have another family. Of course, everybody knows that we have, you know, the real family, the one into which we're born, and then you have the family that you choose, your friends, your peers, your mates. But then if you're an artist, if you're a writer, you have that other family, you know, the family that you, and I always tell my students, you want to meet your family, just look at the books you have on your bookshelf. That's your family, because you've chosen those readings, you've chosen those poems, those short stories, those essays. And what happens, or what happened to me, is that you, at some point, you realize that you have a tremendous amount of affinity with one writer, for example. And I'll mention two in my case. And that's, I'm going to leave aside all my Mexican fathers and uncles and grandfathers. I'm just going to talk about two American fathers that were very important for me. James Baldwin, who taught me a lot back in 1986, when I first came to the U.S. taught me a lot about being a member of an oppressed minority, being someone who loved books, being someone who was, you know, the other one, right, in mainstream America. So James Baldwin was someone that I had so much respect with that I even wrote an essay called Notes of a Foreign Son, sort of my little homage to Notes of a Native Son. So I felt that if James Baldwin was a native son of America, the unseen son, the neglected son, I was the foreign son of America, the one who came from abroad and could never be a part of it. And then the other one, who was also very important at some point for similar reasons, but in a very different way, was Philip Roth. And Philip Roth, his whole exploration about being a Jewish American man taught me also a lot about what does it mean to be an American. And even though, you know, Philip Roth was, I think, second generation American, he was someone who also had to grapple with that identity. So these two very different fathers, like I'm not going to claim that I read every single thing that they read, but I read a lot of what they read. But at some point, I realized that I began to have all these major differences with Philip Roth, not really with James Baldwin, James Baldwin is like a saint. You kind of love everything he does because he's just so humane and so important and so meaningful for Americans. But Philip Roth had some issues. One of them was his misogyny. And I had a lot of problem with that. And the way in which he was like so vain and so proud and to the point of being, you know, kind of stealing his old age. I began to distance myself from that Philip Roth that I really didn't like a lot. I didn't want to learn the lesson of misogyny. And I had to, quote unquote, kill that father, right? That was one of my first acts of literary parricide when I grew up. So, you know, to avoid making a specific mention of my relationship with my father, the father I have in Mexico City, the 85-year-old man, I'm also thinking that as I grew up, I adopted father figures because I felt like an orphan. Does that make sense?
So much. So much sense. As you were talking, I was like, oh God, am I going to have to like report on literary mothers?
Or fathers,
yeah. And thinking about the people I'm drawn to reading over and over again in particular, and like as I was frantically searching my my mind of who that would be, like I realized that they're just could not be more different from my mother, my like living human mother. And I that is really interesting. Actually, like, do Baldwin and Roth like have, do you see any like reflections of your father in what you've learned from them, or is it completely different from like
Well, I hadn't thought about it. Now that you asked the question, I could see that misogyny on my father, my real father. And they are, you know, close in age. Well, not really. No, Roth is older, but they grew up at a time where it was okay to be a misogynist, and it was okay to be, you know, a womanizer. It was okay to be a lot of things. And my father is also a very narcissistic person, like Philip Roth. And it's not that I'm flawless. I'm far from that. But at least I make an effort, right? Like I do make a real effort to not be like that and not to identify myself with a lot of those features that I see in older men. And I'm not a young man, but I still feel that I'm far from that generation that was born, brought in the 30s, late 20s, I don't remember. We can Google it. and my father, who was born in 1938. So that was a very different. And I always think that if you were born, let's say, in the 1930s, you were raised by fathers who were raised really themselves with values from the 19th century, right? Mm-hmm. Because their parents were born in the 19th century or thereof, like right at the turn of that century. So what they learn about human relationships and about especially the gender issues, relationships they had with their wives and women in their life was like really like a 19th century version of how things happen between men and women. And that's really problematic. And then those same values are passed on to you. I mean, you're the youngest in this episode, Jane, but you know, your parents were raised by people who, you know, had very different values than the ones that they taught you. So we're constantly, I think, like grappling with that legacy and trying to, yes, learn from people that we love the good stuff, but put aside the stuff that is not going to help.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about that, actually, like in thinking about the parts of my mother that are in myself that I would like to eliminate. Like a lot of that comes from the misogyny that both of my parents had and have, and that they learned from their, you know, they were born in the 50s, their parents were born in the 20s, you know, and it's just like, it's things that you don't even really start to re-see until you are yourself an adult and you're just like, oh my God, like these things that they said all the time. And, you know, to our
races they were, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, not your parents. I don't know your parents, but my parents had all these racist, homophobic attitudes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everybody's racist, so certainly, like, my parents were in their way, and I am in my way, and like, it's hopefully getting better. But the things that I remember about them that really stick out is just like body image stuff. And like, you know, the derision with which they approached anyone, like anyone who like didn't fit this very, very specific, like, you know, wafer thin, like, beauty standard. And it was just like their moral, value was like, you know, they were stupid. They were like crude and grotesque, you know, like there was just no, if you didn't look a certain way, you had no value. There was just nothing you could do to save yourself, you know. It's just like carrying that on and like trying not to spread it to anyone else has been a real challenge. As I become more and more aware of it, it's just, yeah, it's insane.
Did you have people that you admired growing up reading, or later on discovering maybe in college or thereabouts, and liking them a lot and trying to emulate them, only to find that, oops, they might not actually be the people to emulate?
Writers?
Yeah. Or others. I mean, sometimes it's with music too, like, you know, you grow up with somebody like adoring someone's music and then later finding that they have political opinions or saying some things outside of their songs that kind of informs the songs, but it's kind of pretty abrasive. There was a song I really loved by Cat Stevens, My Lady Darbanville. It's still like one of the most beautiful songs, really, to me. But it's a breakup song. It's sort of like a very dark and sinister Taylor Swift thing, you know, like it's and So at some point I was like, oh my God, you know, like I finally understood what it was about, and it seemed kind of cruel. I mean, I'm now over that one too, but yeah, anything where you felt, oh, I've been going in the wrong direction, where I can't save that person, that role model anymore.
Yeah, man, I'm drawing a blank now, but I feel like there's so many examples of like artists and writers and filmmakers who, like, I feel like most geniuses are like are like half horrible people, you know.
Problematic. That's the word we use. They're problematic.
yeah. But I can't remember now. I think there was a stage where I was like really, really into Newt Hampson, and like I think that he is a very problematic writer, actually. But yeah, I guess I kind of early on like gravitated towards women writers, and like you hear sort of slightly less horrific things about them. actually,
yeah, but they're not exempt. I'm thinking that I read Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar back in the 80s for the first time, and I loved it. The second time, probably about 10 years ago, and I was like, oh my God, all this racist stuff about Asians. Oh. It's like, God. I was horrified. I mean, I still appreciated the stuff, but at the same time, I was, you know, troubled by it, because we read with a very different filter these days, and we're aware of stuff that, you know, we were not aware before, and that raises a lot of, you know, new issues that we didn't examine back in the day.
Yeah, for sure. I actually, that reminded me, like, I think one of my favorite writers of all time is Iris Murdoch, and she is very, I mean, there's like so much racism and anti-Semitism in her work that is like, you just are like, oh, I'm just gonna breeze past that and like get what I want to get of this. But it's interesting because I was thinking of her when you were talking about literary fathers, and thinking about like sort of gravitating towards her style and her like the kinds of like personalities and relationships that she writes about, and it's so unbelievably different from the sort of conventional like ways that my parents thought about relationships or thought about like the categories that people fit into, you know. So it was like I was like, oh, actually I can see this like huge departure from, you know, from that way of thinking in sort of seeking out her books. Like, it was the first time I'd ever seen a character. Have you guys read The Sea, the Sea?
Yes.
I have not.
Like, this character is just like completely obsessed with this woman and like kidnaps her. and sort of it's like a love of from the past. But she's, the way that she's physically described is so like, she's hideous, you know, and he just like can't like get enough of her, and like she's trying to escape and he's like, I have to have you, you know. And it was just like this, I was like, whoa, like you can like my mind was just blown by like this dynamic, you know, because it was so outside of like the value system that I had learned. Yeah, just it was really amazing. And I think like that sort of those writers writing about I mean, in her books there's like a lot of, you know, sort of taboo relationships and like incest sometimes, and just like really, you know, like surprising like high drama, like sort of like soap opera-esque plots and things like that. And I've noticed that like those are the kinds of friends that I gravitate towards also in real life. Like, I'm like, oh, like, who are the most like perverted? Like,
but remember, Game of Thrones is all about incest. So we have an entire new generation that's okay with a lot of murder, a lot of incest. That's Game of Thrones, dragons, you know, colonialism, blah, blah, blah. It's pretty cool these days, all that.
Yeah,
I had a similar experience when I first started reading Hemingway, The Sun Also Rises, and everybody is a drunk. Everybody is an alcoholic. And alcoholism was something that in the community where I grew up was something very stigmatized. I mean, everybody drank a lot, but to be an alcoholic was kind of this very shameful thing. And I had, he wasn't a relative, but anyway, like, and everybody made fun of him. Like, everybody was said, oh, he's such a nice guy. But then everybody made fun of him because he couldn't stop drinking and got like, he wasn't a mean drunk, but he got very drunk at certain events. And then he was sort of the outcast. And to have a whole group of people just living it up and getting shit-faced every single day, and that's basically all you do. You work toward getting shit-faced in the evening and have affairs and do weird shit on the side. That was really a revelation. But then you have to kill them later because they teach you something valuable, that life isn't over if you're drinking too much. But then, yeah, you have to unpack the anti-Semitism, the all the prejudices that are baked into that. And more recently, we talked a little bit about that 4 or 5 weeks ago with another guest, J.K. Rowling. Like, everybody, all my students have to some degree grown up on Harry Potter. And suddenly they realize that this woman who wrote the books where they felt you can be, however weird you are, you can find a really good spot, is actually betraying them in some way or another. And that's always a very, it's a painful thing just when you find out that your parents were basically just telling you shit their whole lives and that they didn't know anything about anything, but they had their opinions on things, wherever they came from. And I feel maybe every 10 years or 20 years, or maybe like every 5 years, there's a new wave of where you just look back at what you've learned from people and how little any of that still makes sense. And it always comes as a huge disappointment, sort of this very sinking feeling in the stomach that most of the things that we cherished at some point turn out to be later not true, or at least not true in that particular way we learned them.
I grew up around a lot of drunks because Mexico is an alcohol culture. So I saw that everywhere I went to, and I ended up drinking a lot when I was young and becoming a drunk. It was kind of, I didn't even think about it. You just become that, which you see as normal and okay and acceptable. And now I was just telling my brother yesterday, probably I buy a six pack that lasts like 6 months because I don't really drink anymore. I wish I drank more because it's really boring to be sober. Like, I regret giving up cigarettes. That's like the stupidest thing I ever did in my life, because life is really boring without cigarettes and alcohol. But at the same time, I was thinking that maybe in 20, 30 years, we'll have people our age saying, you know, I grew up at a time where people were smoking a lot of pot and it was made legal. And, you could find a dispensary at your local mall. If you live in California, I don't know, how it is in other parts of the country. But now the cool thing to do is everybody smokes pot, right? Or takes, the gum is to go to sleep or to relax or to chill or to do whatever you want to do. But I'm just not so sure that it's such a great idea to yet have another addiction that's going to be passed on to the next generation because it's socially acceptable. Do I sound like a prude, like a Republican?
Yeah.
Ohio just legalized pot. So like, yes. No, but I think self-medication is something people have always done. We just look at different things very differently. You know, like alcohol was accepted, pot was not. Now pot is accepted and alcohol becomes kind of frowned upon more again. And so it changes up, but people have always been self-medicating because life is hard to take, you know? And sometimes we just...
Yeah, you become a poet, right? Yeah. You're writing short stories.
Do you find yourselves like moving away from alcohol because your parents like were alcoholics, or towards something else because they weren't doing that, or something like trying to change the pattern in that way?
Tim Trash is not moving away from alcohol. He loves his cocktails. Yeah, that's how I met him.
No, but
hey, bro, can I buy a Bloody Mary? I like this guy.
but that is a problem. You know, my dad would come home, pour some brandy into a glass, and then drink several bottles of beer throughout the evening, and then fall asleep in his armchair. So drinking was very normal in our house, and later became sort of more wine because my sister moved to France and I worked in a wine store, so everybody started drinking a lot of wine. And but there is this thing that I really hate when I look at myself coming home and pouring myself some soju or so, that I'm like, oh my God, you know, like this, like certain rituals have just been tainted by that experience. And I was not a very happy child. It's not that I had the worst childhood in the world or any of that, but I did not like childhood. I think the realization that you're just at the mercy of your parents, you don't have any rights, you don't have any money, you have like settled early on me, and I thought it really horrible, like to be stuck in a place where whatever you want is not really acknowledged in any way. And that comes also out of a very repressive child rearing reality techniques, whatever, in Germany, which were still largely based on Nazi Germany in many ways. And so but to connect the things that I do as an adult back to my childhood is usually super painful, because I want to stay away from that as much as I can. But of course, you're a human being. You do certain things. You can't reinvent the wheel. And at some point, which is the hardest part to me still, even at my advanced age, is to not define yourself by the things that you're not doing like your parents. You know, you can't go around your whole life and saying, well, I never did that, you know, what they were doing, because you're cutting into your life. Just because your parents drank doesn't mean like you can't touch alcohol. Just because your parents smoked or whatever they did, you can't say, oh, I'm not going to do that. That is just as silly and stupid. And you're tying yourself harder, tighter to your parents by doing that, by opposing that. But to wander that way and trying to find sort of your own, and I hate the word authentic by now, but your own way of living, of being in the world is so hard, and like at times, and feels really painful. And we were saying last week too, that at our age, we're still even thinking about our parents and what they might have done, what they might not have done. Is sometimes I'm just like, oh man, it will never go away. And then I take a deep breath, and then I usually recover.
But it depends. It depends which things, because it's okay to drink if your parents were alcoholic. But, you know, we're talking about, you had racist parents.
No,
who were doing things that are morally, what we call morally reprehensible. Which reminds me, now that you said that you hate that word authentic, we should do an episode on words that we hate. I hate the word interrogate. Mm-hmm. Well, let's interrogate, you know, racism. Let's interrogate peace. Let's just do one episode, and we'll. I'm sure that if we have a list of 5 words that we hate, we have enough for 1 hour.
Can I come to that episode?
Yes.
I have some
well, which word do you hate?
I hate problematic.
Oh, now you'll hate me for bringing that up. Oh, God.
Yeah.
No, I know what you're saying, Tim. I absolutely agree that you have to, you know, there is a life to be lived, and you can go around like blaming your parents for everything.
No, it's not just about blaming, but you can't also not go around and try not to repeat anything they did. I mean, like with things like racism or homophobia, which my parents like were super homophobic and stuff. That is an easy part, I feel, just the way I grew up and where I landed in Berlin and all that. But the other parts are the more intricate things, you know, looking like discovering certain tics, certain ways you look that remind you of your parents, you know, like feeling these intimate connections when all I want is not to have an intimate connection, you know. that is really, it gives me the heebie-jeebies still, you know, like to look in the mirror and discovering something you're doing and like you're like, ew, no, I know that, ew, I don't want to do that. Do you, like, Jane, do you have sort of things that you try to avoid, or you try, were you noticing, or that are giving you pause in one way or another? It doesn't have to be creepy or whatever.
Yes. I have so many things that they're all like bottlenecking in my mind. I don't know which to give words to. I think the ones, like the behaviors that sort of disrupt my life the most that I get from my parents is like this sort of compulsive, like catastrophizing of everything that will, how everything that will unfold will be absolutely the worst possible scenario, no matter what happens, you know? And like, I, you know, identified that I was doing that, but I did not realize that it came from them until sort of you know, getting together as adults and and just like watching it happen. And I was like, oh my God, like this is like the most poisonous like way of thinking about things that is imaginable, you know. It was just like so unbelievably just very, very, very intense negativity about like the future. And so I've, you know, you work very, very hard to try to like undo these mental habits and like sort of retrain the way thoughts move through your brain, and you know, 30 seconds back with your parents is just all undone, you know. It's unbelievable. So I definitely like that is something that is like strenuous each day to try not to do that.
That's so interesting when you're raising kids and you see yourself doing things that perhaps your parents did with you, right? It's like, am I repeating the same kind of things in a way that's just automatic, and what's going to happen to these kids if I keep, you know, raising them like I was raised?
So much. Like, I think, I don't know if it was, how did you phrase it, Tim, at the beginning? Like parents that loomed large, maybe. It was like this, like, kind of overbearing presence. Like my mother was a very, very intense, like controlling, like overbearing presence. But in a way that it was hard to recognize, I think, because she was also so positive and like also really like supportive, like overbearing in her support. She was a person you wanted, like I'm saying was because like past childhood, she's still with us. but like she like was a person you wanted to tell everything to you because she was such a like enthusiastic participant in your life, you know? And so that was like a really like wonderful experience in some ways. And then you don't realize how like suffocating and overbearing it is at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then like in contrast, my dad, you know, was like, like so spoke so seldomly that like I didn't even realize he had like such a strong Midwestern accent until like a few years ago. I was like, oh my God, I haven't heard your voice in my entire life. And like suddenly I'm like, whoa, that's how you pronounce Paul? Like that's so funny. So like having that balance of like absent and too present, too absent and too present. I'm like, which of these monsters am I going to be to my kids? You know, like, what am I doing to them? And I don't know the answer. Like, who can tell me? Cause like, I don't know. You guys have to tell me, I guess.
The description of your mom, like struck a nerve because I feel that my parents didn't have really any boundaries or left any boundaries to us. They wanted to be involved in everything while at the same time very being restrictive. So they raised us basically as good company for themselves, but then you weren't really allowed to do anything that they didn't want to. There weren't any dark spots or moments where you could be yourself or by yourself, even though we had to be quiet a lot and like do things, but it was always kind of under constant surveillance. There wasn't much that could be done outside of it. And even though part of my childhood was spent outdoors with friends, building all kinds of huts and caves and all that, like as soon as you entered the house, you had to be a certain way and make yourself completely available to them. And it's just like, yeah, it's terrible, but it's a thing that has stuck with me, and I'm always in danger of replicating that. I don't like that at all.
Yeah, it's very tricky. If you recognize a bad model, then it's very simple. You do exactly the opposite. But you know, I had a great mom. And she passed 6-7 years ago, and I had a great relationship with her. So I don't have a problem seeing that, you know, my son has her mouth. That's, I love that. And that, you know, I have that loving, tender attitude every time I relate to my boy, and that's very sweet and endearing and lovely. But you know, if you have a bad model, then it's very simple. You want to run away from that and do exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah. I also think that happens in, you know, as a writer, when I recognize features from good models or bad models in my writing, I try to run away from that. And I'm thinking if I could give you an example. Maybe, you know, an early influence in my life, Gabriel García Márquez. I run away from magical realism because I love what he did so much that I admire that, but I'm just afraid that if I try to do anything that's close to that, it's just going to be, you know, inauthentic or fake, or it's just not going to flow or be as great, you know, as anything that he did. I don't know if you guys have something like that in writing when it comes to looking like or avoiding to look like anything that your heroes have done.
Like if you're talking about, like, I mean, on like there are heroes that I can't even identify what they're doing at all, let alone like let alone try to copy it. Like if I think about, you know, like the true greats of, I know Tim doesn't like Virginia Woolf, but Virginia Woolf, Toni Morrison, like it's like, how do you try to like copy that? Like you just, that's exactly. Something that's beyond, it's like you read it and you just, like I've had dreams populated by Toni Morrison characters. Like, wow. Like yeah, it's like, powerful. That's never happened with any other writer.
That's beautiful. I'd love to hear one of those dreams one of these days.
Yeah, I will do the taboo thing of describing my dreams to you someday. but yeah, I mean, those things I don't even know. Like, it's, you know, the people who I can relate more closely to or try to copy are, you know, closer to like people who are alive in the similar time, having a similar experience to me, I think. But it never, yeah, I think we accidentally copy people because it seeps into our subconscious and we are basically a compilation of things that we have seen and heard. But to like, if I try to copy someone, it's just like, oh God, it just makes me sick. Like it's so bad.
But who do you look like? You know, it's like, I know who I look like in terms of my family, my mom, my dad, and so on. But as a writer, I think I also know, who do I look like? Do you know who do you look like in your writing?
I think I'd like to look like Camille Bordas. I'd like to look like oh my God, Rebecca Curtis.
Sorry, I'm putting you in the spot.
Oh yeah. like those are people whose stories I've read and been like, damn it, like that is a story I could write if I were 100 times better. like it's in the the same category. It's just, yeah.
do you guys feel that you've developed or discovered a style that is really you?
I think kind of by accident, yeah. Like I think like there's no, like every time I think I've made a huge departure in style, like I'll reread it and be like, oh, this sounds exactly like everything I've ever written. Like I'm like, oh, this is gonna be so different, you know, like mm-hmm. can I sustain mm-hmm. this? And then it's like, oh, it sounds the same. And I think like it's like a testament to that is that like I will read like passages in my journals that just say the same thing as like passages in my journals. I write it and I don't think I've written it before, and I'm just it's like a psychosis. Like I just like I cannot get away from like the thoughts I'm thinking or the way that I'm saying them. It's like, yeah.
Joaquin, do you see yourself like as a?
Yes, but I've done something in a very conscious way from the very beginning. I always said that every book that I wrote would be very different from the other one. I didn't want to write the same book in terms of style, plot, form, and so on. So I've always experimented with different forms, but I assume that there is still something in the writing that it's identifiable as, you know, a Juvenal Acosta book. And even now that I just finished recently two novels, a novella and a novel, they're so different from each other. They're very, very different. One is set in the present time, the other one is set in 1919, so it's 100 years apart. But there's still, you know, my writing, my approach to language, my images, my obnoxious self in each one of those. But being aware of that doesn't mean exactly that I can point out with precision what is it that I think, you know, it's me. Like I don't worry too much about that. I know that, you know, academics do worry with those things. So maybe someone will figure it out. How about you, Tim?
I sometimes feel that what I read at a certain time shows up too much in the books I'm writing. I think what ties what I've written together is more a certain sensibility and a certain very pessimistic view of what the world is all about than a specific style, really. There is something, I think, that I've, a certain terseness that might be more me than other styles, but I've been always trying to push back against that. Like there's a certain very direct, very blunt thing that I've done and that I sometimes return to, but I always try to push against that, because otherwise the terseness becomes too confining. But I'm not sure. Like I think it's really more about the things I write about than the way I write about them, maybe. But I don't know. I have no idea. If somebody took the time and read my books, I don't know what they would say, you know, like that's, yeah.
I was thinking, getting ready for this episode, that actually the only literary examples of patricide I've read in your books, Tim.
There's a lot of patricide, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of patricide.
That's true. You killer.
Yeah, which is exactly a lot of people die in my books. Most certainly.
Infanticide too.
How does that happen? You're the kindest, gentlest person I know, and you have so much murder and horrible things going on in your books.
Yeah, I often have this dream, like not often, yeah, once in a while. It's a recurring dream that I've killed a girlfriend of mine. Oh, and God. I'm stuffing the body in a cavity in a wall or under a floor and think about, oh my God, my life is over. And then, but by the end of the dream, I always know this will be horrible from now on. My life will be altered, but I will get through it. And I wake up and I'm just like a total mess. I mean, just like, I don't know, like I wake up and I'm horrified, but it's just always this killing someone and thinking you might get away with it, that nobody will find the body. And it's horrifying. It's actually worse if somebody came into my dream, like the police or other people, and said, oh my God, you monster, I think it would be fine. But this thing that you will never be able to tell anyone, and that it's slowly going to hollow you out and kill you. I don't know.
There's a weird logic to that, because like I said, I'm sure you couldn't kill a fly even if you try. But you see, writers
try me.
writers from Japan, writers from Korea, writers from Scandinavia, from places where you have no crime, right? You have no murders.
Yeah.
And they write the most gory, gruesome stories, and they film the most gory, gruesome stuff. Like, you need, if you weren't capable of any violence, you couldn't perpetrate any violence on other human. I mean, you sort of have to imagine it just to be sane. You have to kill someone in your dream just to be sane.
I subscribe to that. I like that. Totally. That must be it. That must be it, Joaquin. That must be it.
Have you killed anyone in your writing, Jane?
Not anyone of consequence. No, actually, and I've had someone like recommend that I kill someone, and it made me very uncomfortable. I was oh god. Yeah. I just wanted to, not to, you know, put too fine a point on it, but was it a real girlfriend or like a girlfriend from the past, or was it like a dream girlfriend?
No comment. No, I don't think it's anyone specific. I don't think it's anyone specific. It's just more a feeling of being choked and doing something in order to not feel choked. But that's I want to say something about the words that we hate. Chuckle.
Oh yeah,
I hate chuckle. That. Like, yeah. all of my students use it all the time, and it's
no way
terrible. Chuckle. It's terrible. And yesterday, a guy's podcast I'm listening to, and he's not, I mean, he's sort of a writer, but he's sort of dabbling in thrillers now, and he has this sort of second book out, and he read a chapter in the podcast, which is not about books, and he had a character chuckle in there, and I was like, oh no, there we go again. So chuckle needs to go.
Well, there will be an episode on killing words that we don't like. We'll kill those words.
Yes, we should have an episode.
We'll
just
promise
about...
never use them again.
Exactly. Which is kind of problematic.
But it will force us to interrogate why.
Yeah. Let's interrogate our problematic.
It's time for our recommendations. What do you guys would want to recommend? Jane, you have the first pick.
Okay, I want to recommend this book that I just finished, called So Many Olympic Exertions by Agnes Chen. And it's like, it's just so wonderful. I don't know. It's just like it just really got me at the right time, I think. It's like, the premise is this person working on her dissertation about sports finds out that her friend has committed suicide. And so she's now sort of focusing her work on like famous like quitters in sports. And so it's like just her struggle to like continue, and just a lot of like information about like real sort of sports philosophy and like and why we do or don't do certain things with our bodies and our minds and what we're all doing here. It's really wonderful. Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. Joaquin.
I have this book, I probably recommended it before, Exterminate All the Brutes. And there is a series on HBO that's very powerful, that was directed by Raoul Peck, a man from 80. And this was written by a Swede, I believe, Stan Lindqvist, who writes about the colonial mind that allowed for the Europeans to kill and exterminate literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people in Africa and Asia. And it seems to me very pertinent now that horrible crimes are being committed by the Israelis in Gaza and in the West Bank, because they're thirsty for revenge, they're bloodthirsty, and I'm seeing things that I haven't seen in my life, and I'm just horrified. I think that this book explains a little bit of that, a mindset that allows you to think of the other as someone who must be exterminated. And so if you have the time to do it, it's a fantastic read. Exterminate All the Brutes is Van Lindqvist.
That's cool. Awesome.
Thank you so much. So I will go super superficial in my recommendation. And this is this water bottle. And I don't know, it's a gigantic water bottle. It's a gigantic black water bottle by Tal, T-A-L. Never heard of a brand before. But I found this on the beach several months ago. And I cleaned it up and have been using it ever since. And I don't know what the ounces are, maybe 32, something like that. It's insulated. It's very large. It's too large to carry around constantly, but I schlep it around the house and I fill it up and I drink it. And then I know that I have enough water for the day. And so it comes with me whenever I Zoom or whenever I do something else. It always stands on the table. And it's one of the coolest thing I found on the beach. It is just really great. And it's a really great thing as such. So water bottle by Tal, and it's a gigantic one. And it has also, that is the cool thing about it. It has two openings. You can unscrew it sort of to fill it and put ice in it, whatever. And then it has a very nice little screw top that you can actually comfortably drink from. So even if you don't pour it in a glass like the way I always do it, you can always drink it. And I take it to the beach when I take my dog, water for her. And it's sort of this family thing. You always have enough water with you.
Can I be my mom for a second?
Yes.
You need more than 32 ounces of water a day.
I'm doing my job.
That might be true, but I make up for it in drinking coffee. You know, so.
Yeah, does the coffee in the weather count, Jane? Can you ask your mom, please?
I don't think so, because the coffee's
Yeah.
As your mom, just to be safe.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jane, for coming onto the show.
Yes. Thank
wonderful
you.
Having you. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Our music is by Springtide, and it's their Coney Island Train Blues, and it comes to us via the Free Music Archive. Thanks for listening. And please look in your feed again 2 to 3 weeks from now. Bye, everybody.
Bye.